Okay, welcome everybody. We're going to make a start. We don't have a microphone, so I will try and speak up. We're also being recorded for a podcast. So, we'll try and speak up loudly so it also gets recorded for people who are coming to listen. The workshop, just to make sure you're in the right one, is Supporting Homeless Parents and Families. And I just want to introduce to you Jenny Serrone, who works for St. Mungo's, who's the children and parents and families worker, and also leads on women's strategy, I think that's right.
Yep.
And Maxine Jenkins, who's a specialist health visitor in Leicester, working with homeless families. So they go both going to do presentations of about 20 minutes, and then that will give us time for discussion. Before they start, I just want to just go back to some statistics. I think it was last week, Shelter was 50 years old. And probably if you're as old as me, you remember Sheila McKinney, who was involved at the beginning of Shelter. And I think, you know, we all thought there'd become a time where we wouldn't have homeless families, there would be housing. And sadly, that's not happening. And also the number of children in temporary accommodation rose in the last quarter to its highest, and that was 1,003,000 children who are now homeless, and the number of homeless families housed in bed and breakfast accommodation has increased by more than 300% in the last 5 years. So it's a huge increase, and it's all impacting anywhere in the world. So it is very in the country, so it is quite shocking. And some of us are seeing the impact on health as well. And in London, I know number of homeless families has gone up 32% a year. And the policy is now to disperse families out of London. So some of you are out of London will maybe seeing homeless families. So, but we are seeing the highest number of homeless family that we've seen for 12 years. So it is quite shocking, and it's going up. So I'm just going to hand over to Max, who's going to do the first presentation, and she'll tell me when to press the right button.
So please bear with me, I've got a bit of a cold, so my voice is a bit quieter than normal. So my name is Maxine Jenkins, I'm a specialist health visitor that works with homeless families, but in fact, it's the other way around really. I've been very fortunate to be able to work with homeless families for the last 15 years, and they have given me the specialist knowledge. They've taught me the things that I need to know to be able to help and support them. In Leicester City, we have at this present moment in time 10 different hostels and refuges within the city boundary, and we've got another 6 within the Leicestershire in the county area. And I specifically cover Border House and Brooks House, which is a refuge. Border House has 58 units. A unit is a room, and you can have an adult and 2 kids, or 2 adults and 2 kids in that room. So if you have a very big family, you will have a couple of rooms, and if you have a small family, you'll only have 1 room. So we class it as a unit, so it doesn't actually reflect the number of families that are living there. And Brooks House is a refuge that has 19 flats, and the families think they love it. It's wonderful because they actually have a flat with a door that they can lock, and it's theirs and not have to share with anybody else. Most of the other accommodation in Leicester City is shared accommodation. So again, you get a room, you get an option to be able to use a lounge, a shared lounge, and a shared kitchen. And that has huge impacts on being a parent and the way that you live as a parent. And I myself would find it really difficult to be a parent inside Border House, because you can't do simple basic things like cooking tea at 5 o'clock when you've got one bog standard ordinary cooker that you're trying to share with 2 other families. And once you start cooking, it makes the other 2 families hungry as well. So then they want to eat, so they give their kids some crisps or some biscuits, and then by the time that they can come around to be able to eat and start doing their own food, their kids are no longer hungry. So it becomes a bit of a vicious cycle. It's a very, very difficult accommodation to live in. So I thought I'd try and talk about this as being a day in the life of being a health visitor. So you can see here, I'm trying to contrast my own life. Now at this time when I wrote this, I just finished work at 2:15, well, supposedly 2:15. Invariably it was 10 to 3 and a 70-mile-an-hour drive to the school to go and get my kids. But But that was a kind of disability. And I'm trying to contrast the differences between. And when the gentleman that was talking earlier today was talking about the inequalities, this really does highlight the inequalities between our lives. 6:30 in the morning, I get up and take my son to his job because it's icy and cold, I don't want him riding his motorbike. I have an option to be able to support my son. But this lady doesn't have that option. Her eldest son is actually in a completely different hostel altogether because the place that she's living at doesn't allow children of that age, male children of that age, in there. I have breakfast with my family, I load my washing machine, I load the dishwasher, I haven't got a problem with any of that. Somebody at some point will hopefully get the dishwasher stuff back out and put it away, you dream. Somebody will actually get the stuff out of the washing machine and put it in the dryer for me at some point during that day. But my client hasn't got that option. If she wants to go and get her washing done, she's got to go and stay with it. She can't just leave it there because somebody else will come along. They'll be in the need to use washing machines. They'll empty their stuff out and either chuck it on the floor, or if there's something she likes, she might take a couple of items. So she has to stay with her washing. So doing the washing for me is a 5-second job. Doing the washing for her becomes a couple of hours job. 8 o'clock, my partner actually drops my children off at school for me. She hasn't got that option. Getting her kids to school is going to be quite difficult. Border House is on one side of the city, but most of the families that come into Border House come from the areas on the other side of the city. So they've got to get a bus into the city and then a bus back out again to the school that their children are at. If you go to get on a bus these days, I don't know what it's like in London, but in Leicester, if you go to get on a bus, when you get on the bus with your pushchair, they only allow 3 pushchairs on that are upright. And then after that, it has to be ones that you can fold up. So if you've got a young child as well, you're standing at the bus stop, the bus driver pulls up, sees you've got a big pushchair that's going to take a bit of time to get down, forget it, you ain't getting on. You'll have to wait for the next bus. And buses don't come every couple of minutes in Leicester. You're talking a good half an hour between buses. And certainly in the area where I live, you're better more out into the county, you're talking of once a day if you're lucky. I've lost my place now. Okay. So anyway, go on to the next one. My first visit of the day is a transfer and assessment to a child. As a routine, I will go out and see families that have moved into the hostel, and I aim to try and do that within 2 weeks of notification that they've arrived in the hostel. This particular child that I saw, she'd got a swallowing problem. She'd actually been noted by her mum as having a swallowing difficulty when she was about 8 months of age. She'd approached the GP, but the GP said that he thought it was just teething and it would be okay, and then left it at that, so she hadn't gone back again. But at 2.5, it's not teething, and there's going to be some other issues. Routinely, when we're assessing children at that assessment, we will do we use ASQs in Leicester City. I don't know whether everybody else is aware of those. But this is a questionnaire type thing that tries to identify where a child is at their development. And we would pick up on things like speech and language, which is a very common problem for children that have been homeless for a while. We would also pick up on hearing issues. Very often we're affected by children that are living in very smoky atmospheres. We pick up on issues to do with poor stimulation. If you are stressed to pieces because you're worried about whether or not you're going to be housed tomorrow, you are not going to sit down and play Lego with your child. You're going to be on the phone trying to sort out benefits and other things. So your children's development gets a little bit delayed because you haven't got the time to spend with them. Okay, so at 9:30, back to the office emails. Oh, God. And complete all sorts of referrals. 9:30, she's on her second bus. He didn't let her get on with the pushchair, which is what I was saying before. 10:30, I'm off to clinic. Leicester City have currently got in place a bookable clinic for mainstream health visitors. You have to phone, you book into your clinic, and then you can turn up and be seen. I am supposed to have a bookable clinic within the hostel, but I don't see how it could be worked very easily. Because when you turn up at the hostel, you weren't expecting to be in there the day before. So the chances of you remembering to book in and phone ahead and book in with me is somewhat remote. So we have a very loose booking in system that if you turn up and say, I'm here, you're booked. The families that I see on this particular day, I do minor illness as well as health visiting. So this family I saw that got an ear infection, her mum smokes, and although smoking is a fairly big issue within the hostel, quite a lot of the families are receptive to advice and smoking cessation input, so we will refer them on. I chat on the phone to voluntary services trying to arrange for them to provide a free food hygiene course. I do a lot of blagging. The other week I was on the phone trying to get a family to be fed because they had no cooker in the house that they'd been moved into and weren't going to get one for 2 weeks. And they had no family that could support either. and we managed to talk the Salvation Army that got a cafe on the estate into providing a free hot meal every day for that family for 2 weeks, which was really fantastic of them. So we do a lot of that kind of stuff. 12 o'clock, I've got a visit with an interpreter. We have a lot of families that have come from the asylum service. So they're families that have now had their status decided and been given leave to remain. And then you get 28 days to move out of the accommodation that was provided by NAS whilst you're seeking asylum into, hopefully, into your own home. 28 days is not enough time for you to find somewhere to live. So very often the families will end up coming into the homeless service. So usually you will go from like, ooh, hey, I finally got my status after 5 years of waiting or 8 years of waiting or whatever, really excited, really pleased to, oh my God, I've got to live in this place. And it's shared accommodation. And although they may have been sharing before, they won't have been sharing in quite the extreme way that they have to whilst they're living in boarder house. So it comes as a bit of a shock to families. So we have lots of issues with language, lots and lots of use of interpreters. This particular lady that I went to see, I was talking to her about contraception, because she'd come from a country where, or a background where contraception was just nothing that had ever been discussed with her, ever. She'd already got four kids and didn't particularly want to have any more. So she was not aware of the range at all that's available to her in the UK. So that was why I'd gone to, ostensibly to sit and talk. But while I was sitting and talking to her, I was a little bit concerned about the relationship she'd got with her husband. She seemed a little bit fearful. So I made an excuse about doing a chlamydia test. In fact, she was actually overage for a chlamydia test. She was 25, so never mind. Made an excuse of doing a chlamydia test. So I'd get an opportunity to be able to be in the bathroom with her on her own and just had a quick chat. And at the time, she was saying, no, 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 that everything's fine. But I still continue to talk about what the services would be like if things were not as fine as they seem to be today. On this basis that this was something she might need to know because she was sharing with somebody else and that might be an issue for them as well. The next visit I did was to a child protection family. The both parents of this family had actually been using substances for quite a significant period, but they were now sticking to their methadone program and working really well. And this particular family really highlighted the gulf that was between us. We were talking about food and comfort eating, and I was trying to suggest that if the child got upset, maybe giving him a cuddle or a pat on the head or playing with him would be a better option than giving him a sweet or a bar of chocolate or something like that. And she just could not grasp where I was coming from. I spent some time talking about it, and then I said, well, try and think of a time, something that maybe your parents did for you that made you feel that you were loved. Can you think of something little that maybe your parents did that made you feel loved? And she sat and thought for a bit, really struggling with it, and then she said, yes, I remember. I was on a school trip to the zoo, and my parents tried to come and abscond with me. They tried to come and kidnap me. And it became apparent she was actually in care. And she'd gone on this school trip, and her parents were unhappy about her being in care, although she'd been removed for good reasons. And they had come to the zoo and tried to kidnap her from them and take her back to hers. But it just showed to me the huge gulf that there is between my background and her background, and that gulf that I needed to bridge. So, and that lady always stands out for me for that reason. If we look at the other family, she's 12 o'clock, her little one's been fed. He's been in the buggy now for several hours. He's really fed up. You know, he's been trucked on a couple of buses. He's got managed to get to the school. She's now got to get back again to the hostel, but he needs some food. She's only got £1.50. Thank God for McDonald's. You know, it's not brilliant food, but at least it's cheap. Sometimes people will reach for other things, like a Mars bar, again, because it's like 50p for a pound for three Mars bars or four Mars bars these days. They're really cheap. They're really easy to get hold of. They're really filling. So she will give her child that. It's not healthy, but you can understand where she's coming from. She's got an appointment back at the hostel and to see the family support staff, and she's got to try and arrange a creche facility for her little one. But even if she manages to arrange a creche facility, because the creche is centred at the hostel, her chances are that she'll not be able to access it because she's got to get her other children to school. So by the time she's got her other children across to the school and then come back again to be able to access the creche, it's going to be gone 11:30, at which point the creche session ends. And if she waits until 1:30 for the next creche session, puts him in for that, she'd have to pick him up again at about 1:45 to be able to get on the buses to get back across to go and get the other children. So his chances of having that stimulation, that time, to be able to play and just do those kinds of things like painting and drawing and those kinds of things, is really, really limited while in the hostel. we talk about the accommodation being shared. If you can imagine one bedroom, it's about 10 foot by 12 foot, and you've got three or four beds in it, there is very little space for your child to be able to sit and play. We have a lot of issues with children that are just about learning to be able to lift their heads, and we talk about using tummy time. Tummy time needs to happen on a hard surface. If you're doing it on a soft, squidgy bed, you don't get the same sort of pressure and push back on it. But there isn't space in the rooms for a child to be able to lie on the floor. It is so tight if you've got a couple of kids in there. It's very, very difficult. She gets back onto the buses about 1:45 to go off and get her kids from school. She needs to be able to see some family support staff about changing schools. The only thing that has stayed constant for her kids that are in school is the school. But now it's becoming a real big issue. They're getting into school late, it's making it more of a problem for them. They're very often a bit tired, a bit fed up because of their experience of living in the hostel. So their behaviour tends to go down a little bit. So they tend to, very often, they'll end up getting picked on by their friends. Their friends are having a go at them because their behaviour is changing. If she changes her school, she'll change it to a school that's local to the hostel. And there will be a couple of months gap at the moment between you applying for a new school and actually being placed, and that's because of the sheer quantity of children that are looking for school places in Leicester City. It's very, very difficult for them to get children moved in. By the time she gets them a placement in a school that's close to the hostel, you can guarantee she'll be offered a property to live in that's back over the other side of the city. So those kids will have changed school not just once but three times very quickly. It's really, really disruptive on their education. It's really, really harmful. And to me, if there was some way that we could organise services so that we could get the children minibused around to their local school, it would be so much better for them. This just don't work. I've dashed off, I've gone and picked the kids up, they've brought some friends home to play. See, it's a fairly sort of normal day to me. Her children in the hostel don't get that option. No other mother's going to allow her child to go back with them to be able to go and play in the hostel. And if they did, there isn't a space to be able to play in the hostel. So they stop asking friends to be able to come back and play, because they're not asking their friends to come back and play, they're asking them to go and play as well. Birthday parties are really difficult. You haven't got anywhere that you can have to be able to host a birthday party. We used to be able to book the shared lounge, but it's a very strange circumstance to be able to book a shared lounge and then use that for your children's birthday party. And a lot of parents, you know, you need some pretty good friends to be able to say, do you want to come to a birthday party in a homeless hostel? You know, most families are not going to allow their children to do that. My eyes have got all watery, I can't see a thing now. Oh yeah, 5:30, she finally gets back to the hostel. She can now start cooking tea. And I was saying to you earlier about cooking tea and how difficult that actually is inside that hostel. By about 7:00, she finally gets access to the cooker and she starts tea. And by 8:00, she's getting the kids to do their homework. 8:00, when they've been up since 6:00, it's a long day. 8:00 at night, I wouldn't be able to sit and concentrate on my homework. So it'll be fairly scrappily done. And it's really difficult for the kids to be able to concentrate. There isn't any space. If you're in your bedroom, you've got your mum and your brothers and your sisters in there. If you're in the shared lounge, you've got maybe two other families that are in that space. So there's no space to be able to do your homework. We have got a family support service in the hostel, and they do have an after-school activity, but the after-school is from 4 till 5, and they were still on the buses trying to get back, so their access to those services are very limited. I get tea over, my kids get off to have a bath, and then I go out for a game of squash. In here, in the hostel, there is very few baths. Most of it is a wet room where you get a shower. Most children under 5 don't like showers, so it can be quite very difficult for children under 5 to be able to have basic hygiene. Also, the bathroom is shared, and we have lots of issues with children that are just starting to be able to be toilet trained. You find it too scary to be able to get up in the middle of the night and go to the toilet, because they don't know who's going to be in there. And I would worry about it as an adult, about opening the door and not some strange person sitting on the loo doing whatever he needs to be doing. But as a child, it must be really, really scary. We have this lady's little one wets the bed during the night. And again, it's an issue, it's getting the sheets changed. She can take the sheets off, but she hasn't got any spares. So she'll use her sheet for her child, and then she has to wait until the following morning to be able to change the linen. And it's just really, really difficult. She gets her children off to bed. The other resident then starts telling her about her problems, their problems. And their problems unite them, so they want to be friends. So they spend time, a lot of time, talking to each other about their problems and how they can help each other. And then one family will get embroiled in another family's activities, and that creates more problems for them, because then they're worried not just about their own stresses, but also about the stresses that the other family are experiencing as well. I come back from my game of squash, I win. I'm making this one up. I'm home and I'm halfway and I'm off to bed. It's 10:30 at night. 10:30 at night, she finally gets her kids off to bed. It's a really, really long day. Midnight, fire alarms go off at the hostel. And that's a really common occurrence that they'll go off in the middle of the night. Somebody's come back from wherever they've been fairly late on, started to do some toasting, it's just set them all off. And they all have to troop out onto the street outside. It's cold, it's wet, it's dark, it's scary. Finally gets the kids back into bed. And as I said, the 7-year-old wakes up, she's wet the bed. So you can understand why these children are constantly tired. They're not getting a very good diet. They're not getting much of an opportunity to play. They've got a parent that's stressed to pieces, that is trying to support them, but it actually hasn't got the time to be able to support them in a constructive way. And you can appreciate then as a health visitor that although I go in and do my best, there are limitations on what I'm going to achieve. I might be able to get them to be able to use some frozen veg instead of using quick foods and Mars bars and things like that. But I'm not going to have huge impacts. But what I can do is set people up for when they're moving out. So I can talk to them so they've got their knowledge ready for when they move out to their new home, be able to set things up and make it better. We do a lot of work about routines. Routines is what makes children feel secure when everything else is falling apart around them. So we do a lot of work about getting families to instigate those routines. And those families that can do it deserve a huge pat on the back. Because as I said, I would find it difficult to maintain my usual routines in that kind of environment. So they really, really do work hard to do that. Okay. And I think that's it.
Thank you, Maxie. Yeah, so that gives a really good indication of an example of the impact of homelessness on the lives of people, the ordinary things that we take for granted, but how it impacts on the adults, but also on the children. And you see the developmental delays and also some of the long-term impact for children. Panos Vastanis is going to speak tomorrow, and he'll talk about the changes that even though the family eventually get resettled, hopefully, but for the children, it's more changes, another change of school, getting to know new friends. So not only the impact on the health of adults, but also the mental and physical health of children, which we often forget. So I'm just going to introduce Sarah, who's also here with me, who's an expert by experience. So she's gone, had experience of working being out in the community and going through systems, and her big concern is about transition between being a child and adult, and often people fall through the gaps when they're homeless. And I know Jenny's going to pick some of that up as well in talking about being a parent. And I think set up slideshow. No,
it's this one, isn't it? On the beginning.
Oh, there we go. Thank you. So, thank you, Jenny.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. For those of you who don't know about St Mungo's, we're a large homelessness organisation. We work with about 25,000 homeless people each year, and we have around 2,700 bed spaces. We only have one project in which parents actually live with children. That's a women's refuge for women and children fleeing domestic abuse. So I'm coming at this from a slightly different angle. And this approach, actually, to explain the background to it, I think the reason probably my post was the first of its type within the sector. It's really because we don't think of those that we have in single homeless services as being parents. We don't ask them about their experience of having children or their identity of being a parent. Amongst our clients, about half of the women, when we ask them, and that in itself is a topic I could spend 20 minutes at least talking on, our parents, and about the same number of our male clients. So the background to this is some work that we started in around 2012, which is looking at why women in homelessness services had much poorer outcomes compared to their male counterparts. And some of you may have heard about that. That research was called Rebuilding Shattered Lives. Women told us at the time they wanted coordinated support during pregnancy. They wanted support reconnecting with children. They wanted help understanding care proceedings. And they wanted opportunities to grieve children which had been lost, either to the care system, to adoption, or to being placed with family members, which is a very common permanency option for many of the people we work with. So I've already said that having children is absolutely central to a person's identity. Maxine has just spoken about her daily life and how a lot of that revolves around her work, but also around her children. It's a really important thing for parents. And what women were telling us when we went back after the publication of Rebuilding Shattered Lives, we went back to do some peer research. Women were telling us it was really difficult for them to move on unless we were identifying and meeting their needs around their children. They told us that having some possibility of reconnection or contact or even just some acceptance of what had happened to children which had been lost to the care system were really important motivators to recovery for them. Some of the needs which were identified. I came in on the 1st of August 2015 now, and I said, what do you want me to do? This is a new post. And the response was, well, we thought you might know what he's doing. Okay. So I went off and I spoke to people and I said, what do you need from us? I spoke to workers, I spoke to people we work with, our clients. And they said they wanted support around reconnection and child contact. That's unsurprising. They wanted support and understanding of systems. I think one of the biggest surprises for me, although not a surprise actually now looking back in retrospect, was actually how marginalised people who were parents were from processes. From social service, children's social care processes, from legal processes, from looked after children processes. A lot of the work that I've done has actually been about informing parents about what their legal position is, telling them that they have parental responsibility, what this actually means, that they should be involved in processes, they should be consulted about things which happen with their children. Understanding options and rights. And they also wanted acceptance of past loss. They wanted opportunities to grieve children which had been lost. They wanted some understanding of that. They wanted to understand what had happened and why it had happened. And they also wanted support to rebuild future parenting capacity as well. So the work that we've been doing, so this is a pilot since August 2014. And it was funded through some fundraising, which was associated with the Rebuilding Shattered Lives campaign. So what have I been doing? I've been building organisational capacity within the organisation. Been providing some specialist casework advice. And we developed some tailored parenting classes, as Maxine has spoken about. Parenting, if you're a homeless person, looks very different to being a person who isn't homeless or has an experience of that. Although more generic parenting classes are available, which are great and fantastic, they don't quite match the needs of the people that we work with. So looking at building organisational capacity. I said earlier, of the people that we ask, about half of us tell us they're parents. That in itself is a big question. One of the things which really became apparent to me was a very simple thing. We have an electronic database which we record all client information on, much like many of you will have. It was possible to save or create a new client record without having to record, have you asked the client if they have children, if they're a parent. You were able to bypass that and save that record without having to ask the question. So that was one of the things which we changed quite early on. And unsurprisingly, we had much more parents being identified. We had lots more needs being identified. Workers won't ask the question for all types of reasons. So some of the work we do is supporting them to actually ask that question. And workers need knowledge, skills, information and confidence in being able to support their clients that they work with as well. Some of my work's been about training, it's been about individual casework advice with our workers. Creating resources such as fact sheets, commonly asked questions, things about how could you support somebody whose child's being adopted, what is parental responsibility? We have Mother's Day coming up very soon, and we have several projects which are female only, and workers there will say that those are Mother's Day is a very, very stressful time sometimes within those projects. So it's giving some advice to workers on the sort of things that you can do to manage some of those emotions and feelings that there are about pinch points such as Mother's Day and Christmas as well. It's about identifying good practice, so coming to events like this, recording, disseminating that knowledge, talking to people in the field so that we can actually embed that really good practice within the organisation. And of course, all of this must be underpinned by an organisational foundation in which we have really good safeguarding. Because actually, as we would expect, by actually asking people we work with about their experience of being a parent, sometimes that identifies quite immediate safeguarding issues for us, which we need to be able to confidently and properly respond to. So I'll talk a little bit about the specific casework advice. This takes up about 30% of my time. It says, I used to be able to say there was one of me available to about 350 projects. We've actually got some specialist family workers who are within individual services, which I think is great because I think that's a recognition that you actually need to commission this type of support within mainstream homelessness services. So they contact me, I support, I provide advice to the worker goes off and does the majority of the work, the majority of the time. It's great because you learn by doing things, don't you? Also, workers have that relationship with the client, they have that rapport with the client to go off and do the actions which we need to do. We need to identify no-cost legal advice sources. About 50% of what I get asked is legal stuff. And I've already said this, many clients are unaware of their rights. So actually, clients can actually feel quite empowered, actually. They can feel a renewed confidence, actually, when you actually say to them, this isn't right, what's happening here? You should be involved in this process. We can help you to make contact with the people you need to in the local authority, for example. One of the things which is really important, and I think sometimes workers think that we need really sophisticated models and services to support people who are homeless, who are parents. Actually, one of the biggest things that is really important, one of the best uses of a worker's time is actually just to listen to somebody. A lot of the time, people actually want somebody to talk to. And a really good case example I can use to illustrate this is we were working with a woman. She had 7 children successively removed from her care over the course of about sort of 10 years or so, throughout this entire 10 years, during which time she's had very traumatic things happening to her repeatedly, one of them being the removal of her children. At no point had anybody actually said to her, do you want somebody to talk to about this? And it was actually something which the woman actually really valued, the worker just asking that question, making themselves available and just talking to them about how their thoughts and feelings about what they had experienced. The reason why people won't seek out support for those sorts of things is because there aren't a huge amount of specialist services available for them, but also people really fear being judged. They won't seek out the usual sources of support that you might do. So Maxine spoke about people in the hostel, talking to each other. If you've had an experience of your children being removed from your care, that's a very stigmatising thing. It's very taboo in society. There's an expectation around motherhood that you should be a perfect mum and you should be a perfect parent. So when you actually fall below that societal standard which is set, you can face pretty harsh judgment from people. So people will internalise all of this negative feelings for many years, which can cause lots and lots of problems, particularly in terms of substance misuse as a coping strategy for that. And explaining and understanding systems is really important for the people we work with. I do an exercise on staff training where I get people to, I talk to them throughout the whole legal process of making a child protection referral right through to a child being adopted. And I break it down to pieces on different pieces of card and they have to put them in order. These are professionals. I've just told them about the process and they struggle actually to put it into order. So you can understand somebody who's experiencing acute stress and has a history of very often lifelong adversity, actually how they can struggle to understand this process. So having somebody who isn't involved perhaps, who's a little bit more independent, who can explain what's going to happen next, can be very, very valuable to somebody who's undergoing perhaps care proceedings. One of the things which we have implemented is a Mackenzie Friend Scheme. So these are lay advisors who can attend court with litigants in person. And this is something which we've had to implement because of changes to legal aid scheme from the 1st of April 2013. So lots of our clients who are involved in what we call private law proceedings, so those are commonly with the other parent, they need to attend court and we provide a lay advisor who can attend court with them. It can make all the difference to somebody actually pursuing an application for contact, for example. If they know that if they do have to go to court, they're not going to be on their own. So in that way we can reduce some of that justice gap for people. Some of the outcomes here in terms of sort of what we might call more hard or expected outcomes. At the end, presentations will be available later online. At the end of my presentation there's a link and you can click through there to a 2-page briefing which summarises some of this work, and there's lots of other outcomes which are on that briefing. Looking at some of the soft outcomes for people, many of you will be familiar with this. It's an outcome star which St Mungo's developed many years ago with Triangle Consulting, and lots of services use variations of this. So this is where we looked at what we call softer outcomes for people. One of the things we find, first of all, is that women coming into services, they start off and stay at lower numbers on this as well. So that's something to always bear in mind. Here is a bit of data where we looked at clients who engaged with the Children and Family Support Advisor service. Primarily these are casework clients, looking at non-engaged. We've now got a far higher number on the engaged to do the data comparison, but the actual percentages aren't different. So what we see is in every prong of that star, with exception really of self-care, there is improvement. So actually receiving some support around children's matters doesn't only produce some of the outcomes you might expect, like having some contact with your children or re-establishing letterbox contact or entering into psychotherapy to deal with loss of children. It actually has an improvement in functioning across the whole range of those soft outcomes as well. The reason why we do this comparison is we compare people who are in the same projects. We'd expect linear progression of some sort anyway in our services. We would obviously hope that's the case. This also compares clients who are living within the same accommodation project. So it gets rid of that, probably what's the hugest variable, which is the effect of the project. Itself, the performance increase we would expect to see. Biggest changes are in mental well-being, motivation as well. And about 80% of our engaged clients record positive outcomes on the outcome star, compared with about 50% who don't. So as well as those expected outcomes that we would expect to see, we can also see that actually helping people with stuff to do with their children helps them in function in all sorts of ways as well. So some of the future plans is there's always work to be done in terms of embedding our work, both within the organisation, but also sharing that across the sector as well. And what we'd like to do is also evaluate and develop an evidence-based model of this as well. And funding is obviously an issue for all services. I don't need to remind you of this. So these links will be in the presentations when they're circulated. And the second one is a link to the briefing, which I've mentioned. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Lots of time for questions. So, Jane.
Thank you. That was absolutely fascinating from both of the speakers. And it just goes to show however many years you're around homelessness, you still always hear something new and something different. So thank you for that. My question is, I think we're all aware that homelessness is on the increase with both singles and families. And it's very reassuring to see how switched on and in tune you are with the clients that you're serving in hostel environment. What we do also know, though, is that bed and breakfast accommodation is increasingly being used. We know that the guidance hasn't changed about the maximum time that people should expect to stay in B&Bs. So I guess my question is, what support services are there? And it's an open question, really, and I'm asking because I don't really know, and I don't know in Leicester, and I wish I did, because I should know, and what's happening, you know, work locally, so to both speakers, really. What sort of support do they get in B&Bs?
None at all, yeah. I would imagine, unless I would imagine that they are meeting that threshold for child in need. Or child protection. I would imagine probably a lot of those families in B&B accommodation probably aren't really engaged with any type of support or service. So I think probably there's some work there about us as professionals all being very alert to those additional needs that those children are going to have. And perhaps filling out that long old CAF form really might be one way to actually identify those children's needs systematically.
In Leicester, if you've already been supported by your mainstream health visitors, she will continue to work with you if you moved into bed and breakfast accommodation. But we have a lot of families that will move into bed and breakfast accommodation that we are not aware of, particularly families that are placed there by social services rather than by the council. And the ones that are placed there by social services can sometimes stay in bed and breakfast accommodation for an awful lot longer than the 6 weeks that is permitted for housing accommodation. At the moment, we haven't got any system of identifying people in bed and breakfast accommodation. It is something that we've been trying to work on for a long time.
Yes.
I'm hopeful that as we move to be having health visitors employed direct commission through public health, that we might get a little bit further with trying to get that in place. But at the moment, we haven't got a referral system in place.
I'll just say something about London. Following the Laming review after the death of Victoria Columbier, Lord Laming recommended that there was a notification system across London that was set up called Notify. So when children who were homeless, so were in bed and breakfast or hostel accommodation that was often run by local authorities, that all the relevant people would be notified that there was a homeless family who's moved into the area and needed to be followed up. So that was the police, education, if there was school-aged child, social services and health. So primarily health visitors, but I'm not sure how that system is now functioning, but there does need to be a notification system, especially when we've got families moving, not only across boroughs now, but moving across counties, and some families are very, very vulnerable. So it is a huge concern. Okay.
Yeah. The lady in the blue top, and then after we'll go the lady at the back.
Yeah, sorry, it was just on the first question that I think I'm consuming that a lot of people here are from the health side. Whereas I'm actually housing, and people really should get in touch with local housing teams, because certainly with my team, they're expected when they take homelessness application to make referrals to children's centres, to make sure they're getting healthcare, to do any social services referrals that are necessary, to do work club referrals, benefits assessments. You know, I expect my team to do all of that, and I know that's not the same across the country, but we actually have an issue getting health services involved. particularly when we do move slightly across
the border. We have, unless we've had blips when things have been better with the housing situation, it's about getting it up into people's minds and keeping it there in the forefront. And I think until we actually health actually has a presence within the housing options department, I don't think we will keep it high enough. Because when I go in and do some training or some sessions with people, we get more referrals, and then a few months later, it all sort of weans back off again.
I'm
we
just
need to have
that
both of
those, because from my point of view, health aren't that interested.
Mm.
Whatever we try and get them
involved.
Yeah.
What area?
Yeah.
What area?
Kent.
Okay.
Well,
we tried various things before, and we actually do now have one person that we're hopefully setting up a project with. but we've had various issues where we've tried to go out to various teams to do training. We've invited people into Work Shadow to see what we're doing. We don't really use hostel accommodation. Our families go into self-contained houses mainly. But actually, trying to get things set up is perhaps in some ways more difficult because we don't have families in one place. But we're really open to ideas for how we can be helped by other services.
Okay.
And I just think so just that people should speak to their local housing teams to find out what's going on.
Okay.
There was a lady right at the back that's been waiting.
Lady
away.
At the back, yeah.
Yeah, I've got a question for Sarah. I was just going to say, and the lady just spoke, that the health service keeps changing all the time, and I'm sure that doesn't help at all. So, you know, there may be people who, you know, could be engaged, but you don't know where to find and how to find them. I think that's a real challenge. But my question was to Sarah. I'm wondering how we can better use lived experience, and I'm thinking about you've had experience of some of the services that have been discussed, and would it have helped you if you'd have been able to speak to somebody else who'd been through something similar, you know, services to you?
I think services do need to use lived experience more, because actually being on the receiving end of that care, you're going to have a completely different view to the staff providing that care. you know, I know for me, a lot of my experiences are in mental health services. So when I was technically homeless, I was in a psychiatric unit at the time, so I wasn't on the streets. You know, but my view of some of them, they were quite dismissive. They, you know, they weren't always warm. They had their own stuff going on. They were stressed. You know, and they probably wouldn't have seen it like that. And I think actually the value of using, you know, service user experience, experts by experience, actually it highlights some of them very, very simple, basic things that actually people don't recognise the value of it. So people often don't recognise the value of actually just being listened to. You know, sometimes it's like when you, if you get to a point where, I don't know, like, coming up to 18 was very, very difficult for me. And one of the things I was told that I was going to be an adult soon and that I was too old to self-harm. Work that out. But staff say things when they're stressed and don't realise the impact of it, and sometimes it's just highlighting that to them helps. But also, people, they don't realise how scary it is when you're coming up to being 18. You suddenly go from being in an adolescent ward with people that are around about your age, and then you're suddenly going to be chucked in with a load of adults. I was also diagnosed with a personality disorder on my 18th birthday, as if it just developed overnight and I woke up with it. And I was also put on stronger medication because I was an adult now and I could deal with that. You know, and a lot changes very, very quickly. So I suppose transitions is one thing that I feel really, really strongly about. And that a lot of people do slip through the net, you know, because as well the differences in criteria for services from being a child to being an adult. So yeah, I think lived experience is vital to improve that and get it right.
Thank you. So in the room, you can see how a model is starting to develop and what's needed, whether it's for homeless families or single homeless people. And I'm part of a team that works in South London in the teaching hospitals there, and we actually have multidisciplinary teams, and we have housing workers. So we've got Tyrone here, but we've got housing workers, social worker, as well as health workers, but we also have people with lived experience. So we have the peer advocates, which is key in helping people through the systems and going with people to appointments and helping them to raise their confidence. So we've now got a new project where we're going to have somebody with lived experience who will take people when they get housed to help them through the resettlement. These are times of real vulnerability when you just need somebody to help you through often complicated systems, the bureaucracy of housing and social services and health, and going in and registering or you know, going and getting keys and going to a new home. It's that time you need support. So, Rachel, do you have a question?
Yeah, I was just going to follow up on your point, actually. Sorry, I don't know your name. My name's Rachel Dare. I'm a health visitor. I think it's a similar job to what Maxine's doing in Hastings. And we, probably about 10 years ago, there wasn't a homeless team as such, yes, and the generic health visitors were really, really struggling to actually manage the temporary accommodation refugees in there. And I was lucky enough to be given the opportunity to sort of do a scoping exercise of exactly what that meant in numbers and what the needs were, and look at how many families the generic health visitors were able to work with and how many they were missing that were completely falling through the nets in these temporary accommodations because of the speed at which they were falling through and because there was no notification system. So just did a piece of work around finding out who the relevant people were in the organisations who I could set up that notification system with. So that involved working with three or four local authorities who were all placing in the Hastings area, because Hastings has a housing stock which is relatively cheap compared to those areas like Tunbridge Wells and parts of Rother. So they they are continuing to bring their families in. And it is about personal contact. It's about phoning that department, setting up links, maintaining those relationships, which need to be worked on almost on a daily basis. It's formulating those relationships, going back when they fall down and saying, have you got any new families? Because they have changes in staff as we do. So it's very mutually supportive. And that's the only way that we can do it, is maintaining those relationships in order to get the referrals and keep getting them in, which is quite exhausting, but we've luckily now got an admin worker in our team that's able to do that. So the referrals come into us by email, and we see families within 40 hours of being placed and start working to integrate them into the local community. But it's hard work.
I was going to say, we've only got time for one question because we're running slightly over. I know this lady with the scarf has been waiting a while. So what do you want to...
It's been a lot of talk to me about support for mothers, parents and stuff. But what about in terms of support for mental health for children? Not necessarily the county route, but just low-level services that seem to be so lacking in order for children to build resilience and coping mechanisms of their own. We've talked about how stressful it is for mothers, but it's extremely stressful.
We haven't got any direct services for under fives. You can access CAMHS once you're over five in Leicester, but you can't do it if you're under five. We do have nursery nurses that work alongside us. At the moment, my nursery nurse is on maternity leave, but she does spend a large quantity of her time helping parents to understand the impact that the situation has had on the children, and helping them to spend the time and recognise that with them. Whether you have different services.
I can't really add anything to that.
I
think it's a huge gap in the service.
It is.
I think there's...
level, counselling for children, play therapy, music, football, whatever it takes, time.
I think there's a lot... there's a lot of pressure on schools and there are a lot of people going into schools to around developing emotional health and awareness. I think that's kind of one of the things that hopefully they're going to improve, because there's a lot of pressure on them to do so. But I know, I volunteer with Samaritans as well, and one of the things that we do is go into schools for free and deliver emotional health sessions. And there's also a teaching resource that can be downloaded from the internet around, use of them tools in PSE lessons and talking about difficult subjects with all children, not just children in care or children who are homeless, but with all the children. But in terms of specific services, I wouldn't know.
And I'd just add to that as well is making sure that the commissioners are aware of the families and single homeless people who are out there in the community, that there is a duty to commission services for the local population. And so it is making sure that information gets on to the Joint Strategic Needs Assessment and the Health and Wellbeing Board. So going to meetings, really raising the profile. Case studies are really powerful, and also for commissioners to be able to come out and actually talk to people who have that lived experience, it's extremely powerful to say, this is what my experience is like, this is what my needs are like, and including the recognising the needs of children who are homeless. So there's a wonderful book by an author, a famous children's author, and the name goes out of my mind, but she writes a lot of books for children, called The Bed and Breakfast Star. I always say to student nurses when I have them read that book, it's like Maxine was saying about the impact it actually has on a child of being homeless. A very, very powerful book. And the other thing I would say is about one of the keys is having homelessness forums. So making sure people are meeting together, discussing strategies, looking at what legislation's happening, but practically working together to be part of the solution, and we are all part of the solution here in this room. So thank you very much. Keep networking, and thank you to Maxine and Jenny and Sarah. So thank you very much. Enjoy your lunch. Hi, thank you. Oh, Sarah. She's got her card. Yes, she's got her card.
It's
all right.
Yeah, no.
Thank you guys very much.
I might just take
it.
Very interesting.
Yeah. I remember
did
you
just show up
in
particular area and
put
paper to my pillow?
Yeah.
I did a conference years ago. So I'll do whatever stand rocks and do it.